Welcome to Chair Chats, an online web series hosted by me, Jamie Harrison, the chairman of the South Carolina Democratic Party. Our goal in this series is to begin to look at political leaders, activists, and people involved in politics in a three-dimensional manner. We will move past the political caricatures to get to know the individual. So now, let's chat. In 2004, he created a grassroots phenomenon. He launched his presidential campaign declaring that he was from the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. And his campaign used the internet to create a revolution in campaign strategy. As chair of the DNC, his 50-state strategy revitalized dying state parties and laid the foundations for Democratic victory in 2006 and 2008. I am pleased to welcome to Chair Chats my friend, my mentor, the governor and doctor, Howard Dean. Governor, welcome to Chair Chats. Thank you. This is a very, very special Chair Chats. This is the first time that we actually have a live audience here, Governor Dean, for our Chair Chats program, and I'm really, really excited that it's you who's sitting in that rocking chair.
I'm excited to be here. Thanks very much.
So, Governor, the way that we do this, we'd like to hear a little bit about the background of some of our guests. So I would love for you to share with us a little of your background growing up. So I know you grew up in Long Island. Hamptons, nice middle-class family. Your dad was in finance. You're the eldest of four. Your family was generally Republican, right?
Yep.
So how did a young man who grew up in that atmosphere become the person who represents the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party?
Well, I went to school in the 60s and 70s, and that kind of changed everything. It was Vietnam. I had a low draft number, flunked my physical. The government was lying to us a lot about what was going on, and it was pretty apparent. I had two African-American roommates. They had never been to school with a white person before because they came from segregated schools, one in Charleston and one in Memphis.
And you actually asked for an African-American
roommate. I asked for an African-American roommate because after high school, I was young when I got out of high school, and I went to England for a year on an exchange scholarship, and one of my best friends was Nigerian. So I thought to myself, well, this is great. You have an African roommate, an African friend, and you know nothing about what's going on in the civil rights movement in your own home country. Which is what I did. I asked for an African-American roommate and got two, which was an incredible year because neither of us knew anything about anything, and none of us are shrinking violets, so I had very little white liberal guilt. So we had very blunt discussions from our point of view, and that's really how you have to. It was very respectful, and I learned to kick butt playing bid whist, which was really fun. I do that better than most folks. But I learned a hell of a lot, and they learned a hell of a lot.
And one of your roommates was Ralph Dawson, who's from Charleston, South Carolina, and he has a special tie also.
He was one of my roommates, and he became a political crony. He served on the DNC Rules Committee, and he was also Jim Clyburn's student in Jim Clyburn's history class in Charleston, South Carolina. It's pretty cool. So... Anyway, it was the Bobby Seale trial was going on in New Haven. I mean, a lot of us were somewhat. I was never too far left because in those days, these days the right wing has got all the crazy people in it who don't care what the facts are. In those days, it was the left wing that was crazy. People talk about the left in this country. There is no left in this country. When I was a student, there was a real left wing, and they were blowing up buildings, and they were unreasonable, and they were, spouted ideology and didn't care what the facts were. And that's, of course, all true of the right wing today. But I learned a lot. And what happened was I was against the war, and I was very sympathetic with civil rights because of my learning situation my freshman year. But I got sick of politics. I just thought it was awful, and I just blotted it out until I end up. I went to work on Wall Street for a year or two. Well, first I went ski bumming and washed dishes and poured concrete and skied 280 days or something. And then I came back, went to Wall Street, hated it, and went to a post-bacc program in Columbia night school, and ended up going to medical school. I had taken no sciences, because we had, of course, it was the 60s, there was no requirement to do anything when you went to college, so, including study. So I got serious and went to a post-bac program, got an MD, and then was sent to Vermont with the MATCH program by computer. And I walked into the place in Vermont to register to vote, and this lady, I said, I'm not sure whether I should register as a Republican or a Democrat. She said, I can tell by looking at you, you're a Democrat. We don't have party registration here, but my sister's a state senator, and I'll have her meet you. Yeah. So I met her, and I was a big fan of Jimmy Carter's, because I believed at the time the Democratic Party had no future unless we could nominate a Southern Democrat for president, because that was at the time that the South was starting to shift away from the Democratic Party. And I thought we needed a slightly more conservative Democratic Party, not because I was conservative, because I wanted to win the election. And I got involved in Jimmy Carter's campaign, and that was the rest of the story. Yeah. There's a great story about that, but I'm not going to take up the whole time with a monologue, so I'll let you ask your next question.
Given the news recently about President Carter, and you know, a lot of folks are reflecting on his presidency and his life after the White House, I would love your thoughts and opinions on him as president and on his legacy.
So, I always liked Carter. When he first ran, it was 76, and I was in medical school, so obviously I didn't have a lot of spare time for politics. The second time he ran, I was doing my second year of residency, and I did have some time. I took some electives in Washington. And the lady down the street, the state senator, she and her sister became my mentors. They had kids my age. And they were running the Carter campaign in Vermont. The Carter campaign in Vermont was very important because everybody knew that Ted Kennedy, who was running against him as a dissident, was going to win Massachusetts, and Carter wanted to win another New England state that had the primary in the same day. So Vermont was an important primary for him. So we worked hard. We won the primary by a lot. And Esther Sorrell, the state senator, said, well, you should be a delegate to the national convention. I said, you've got to be kidding. I've lived in the state for 2 years. I don't know anybody. So they, of course, in those days, there were no computers, so they just pulled out a Rolodex and said, here's 229 names. You should call them and tell them Peggy and Esther sent you. So I did that, and I got elected as a delegate. And this was before I quit drinking. So so I went to Madison Square Garden, which is where the convention was, and all the young people my age were for Kennedy. But I'd been schooled by the older folks and was sort of adopted by them as their mentor or mentee. And so I voted all day with the Carter people and drank all night with the Kennedy people at Rosie O'Grady's, which wasn't very far from. So when I got back after Carter won the renomination, so I get back and the state chair called me up. I promise I'm not making this up. So the state chair called me up and he said, could you come see me in my office? So I said, okay. So he said that your county, which was not very big, but it was the biggest county in the state by a factor of 3 over the next county, and you have to win this county if you're a Democrat in Vermont. If you don't, you're no place. You have to come out of Chittenden County with a huge margin. So he says the chair of your county is very ill, and she's going to have to step aside, and we'd like you to be the county chair. And I said, you got to be kidding me. I've lived here for 2 years. I don't know anybody. And he said, oh, there'll be an election, but don't worry about that. We'll take care of that. Well, I said, well, that's not what I meant. I meant, how can I do the job if I don't know anybody? And don't know all the people you have to know in a job like this. And he said, I know. You lived here 2 years. You don't know anybody. But for some reason, you're the only person I can find that gets along with both the Kennedy people and the Carter people. So you're going to have to take the job. So that's how I got into politics.
You're a bridge builder even then.
Right. So I think Carter was great. I think obviously his presidency as a one-term presidency was, he probably doesn't think it was all that successful. I actually think that he did some very good things as president, the biggest of which was the agreement between Begin and Sadat. That has transformed the Middle East. I think you measure presidents by looking 30 years back at their 20 years back at their presidency. I don't really think you can tell how great a president somebody has been or how awful until you look back. There's one recent exception. But I don't think you can really tell until about 30 years, because you've got to look at what's permanent, what's lasting, and what did the lasting change do? I hated Lyndon Johnson, for example, because it was Vietnam. They were lying to us. You know, but if you look back at Lyndon Johnson, I think he's one of the great presidents we had. Why? Because his domestic stuff was unbelievable and it transformed America in a permanent way, both in civil rights and in health care and so forth. And because it turned out the Vietnam was a terrible tragedy for America because we lost 57,000 people, but didn't alter the geopolitics of the world at all. So it was very damaging to us as individuals. But if we hadn't done it, nothing would have been different, except we wouldn't have learned the lessons about not doing things like that. Iraq, for example, is going to be very different. The consequences of us going into Iraq have transformed the Middle East, probably not for a very good way. So if you look at Carter's major achievement, he brought a relationship to the Middle East which has never existed before, peace between Egypt. It was a cold peace, but they cooperate to this day to fight terror. I think both regimes have their problems. But it was a lasting change for the better, I think, in the world. So I judge Carter as a pretty good president, even though he was only a one-termer.
When you ran for president, did you consult with President Carter at all? Did you talk to any of the other...
I talked to them all. You got to talk to them all. You see Mike Dukakis and you see everybody. He's a remarkable human being and a deeply sincere, wonderful person who is heavily influenced by his children. I remember him endorsing President Obama, and he said, you know, I can't do anything different than this because around our dinner table on Sunday afternoons, we have three generations, and everybody in my family is for Obama, and I got to be for Obama too. And he did the same thing with same-sex marriage, which I think for a religious person from the South is an extraordinary thing. He's one of the most sincere, genuine people I ever came across, and I've always admired him enormously for that.
Well, you know, there are a lot of folks who admire you, Governor, for what you've done, even after you ran for president, but what you've done for the Democratic Party. One, your campaign, as I said in the opening, revolutionized campaigning in this country. You brought in the utilization of the internet. You got the grassroots. You focused once again on grassroots organizing, which is such an important component of campaigns today. And many people, and I'm one of them, stand up and say that we would not have won the majorities in the House and the Senate in 2006, and Barack Obama would not be president today in 2008 if it weren't for you and your 50-state strategy as DNC chair.
Okay, so I can get some credit, but not all the credit you're giving me. We started out in my presidential campaign in a state of 610,000 people with $160,000 in the bank. This was not, by most people inside Washington's estimation, a serious campaign. However, what the campaign I realized was about was empowering people. It was about giving people back the power that they ought to have in a democracy. And it was about, I was actually really running against the Democratic Party, although I didn't realize it at the time, who had caved in and were voting for all Bush's tax cuts, which of course were huge deficit raisers. We were voting for the war in Iraq, which I knew we were being lied to because I was reading the British intelligence and they knew there were no weapons of mass destruction and all that stuff. And I thought to myself, first of all, I've seen this movie before because I grew up during the Vietnam era. And secondly, there is the whole world out there where people have given up. Mm-hmm. And so you know, I'm happy to have done that, being an empowering agent. But the people who drove the campaign, created all the stuff that got Obama elected, were 23-year-olds. Because my campaign was the first campaign. There's a guy who nobody except a few people here that are more or less my age remembers, Gene McCarthy. And Gene McCarthy is very different than I in many ways. But the similarity is, in 1968, Gene McCarthy ran against an incumbent president, Lyndon Johnson, and did so well in the New Hampshire primary that Johnson concluded that he might not win the nomination. He just said he wasn't going to run for another term. This was over the Vietnam issue. And it was my generation's introduction to electoral politics, because everybody, you know, shaved all their long hair and beards and everything and went up to knocked on doors. And it was called getting clean for Gene. I'm serious. I'm not making this up. So we all went up and knocked on doors all over New Hampshire, and McCarthy got about 40-something percent of the vote against an incumbent president. That's not so great for the incumbent president. I think I was sort of in that way the Gene McCarthy for our generation, not because I was so smart, but because I trusted 23-year-olds enough, partly out of my own ignorance about the internet, and they built the whole thing. They built all this stuff. In those days, there was no YouTube, there was no Twitter, there was no Facebook. And these kids built all this incredible apparatus that raised this enormous amount of money. Now, and we gave them the power to do that. We allowed them to do it. And so it was an entire generation who came into the political process as a result of this one campaign that gave them freedom to shape it the way they wanted to. Now, there's a capitalistic success story here. They were so good, even though I didn't win, they were unbelievable. One of them, or about 12 of them actually together, started a company called Blue State Digital. I hired Blue State Digital when I became the chair of the DNC, because Terry McAuliffe did a great job as chair. He had a $6 million surplus, which is unheard of after a presidential campaign, in a brand new building, but there was nothing in the building. He'd been sold a bill of goods by the Washington establishment, and nothing really worked. So I hired these Blue State Digital to come in and build all the stuff that Obama later used to win the presidency. They started a company, this Blue State Digital, and Obama hired the company out from under me in 2006 to gear up for the presidency. And they later sold their company for $100 million to WPP, which I'd say is a pretty good start for people who are about 27 years old and worked for 4 years. But it was a campaign of empowerment. The other thing that was so interesting about it is when it really took off in August of 2003, we were having these big rallies. And I remember a rally where in a square in Seattle where all you could see was people, and I was just blown away. And afterwards, a lady who was my age came up to me and said, I thought I was all alone. I didn't think there was anybody else who believed the things that you're talking about. And of course, there were 10,000 people in this place. And I realized what I was doing was giving people hope.
Yeah.
And that's what really transformed politics. The nitty-gritty in the infrastructure was a big deal. And Obama did use it. Of course, he had much more discipline. And we did a lot of things wrong. I did a lot of things wrong. And he had a great team. And he took what these young people invented in my campaign and had perfected during their time at the DNC and put it on top of it, a really disciplined model of identifying every single voter who was going to vote for Barack Obama and making sure they got to the polls. It was an extraordinary thing, those two campaigns. We won't see campaigns like that again for a very long time in this country. It was unbelievable what they did.
Well, in your description, particularly with the woman, it sounds like the Obama team did build on something that you were focused on, which is hope. I mean, that was the core of what his campaign was about, is getting people to believe in
It was, but there was also something else going on. And again, our campaign, and he'll tell you, I mean, they took all our stuff. They looked at what didn't work and what needed to get given the heave-ho, and then they perfected the stuff that they thought was really great. But the secret of Obama's campaign was what I call the first global generation. Some people call it the millennials, but I don't like that term. Because I think it is a global generation. I think there's a real connection between the kids who did Tahrir Square in Cairo and the people who elected Barack Obama president of the United States. In fact, I've interviewed the kids who did Tahrir Square, and they told me, we got our inspiration off the net from Rosa Parks, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, Nelson Mandela, and Mahatma Gandhi. That is the world that we live in today, where young people learn from all over the world about what's going on elsewhere and take each other's models. So the thing about Obama's first campaign, which was so extraordinary, is he was the first candidate of the first global generation. That is, he's multicultural, and this is the first multicultural generation in the history of the United States. You know, Ralph and Don, my roommates, they didn't know any white people before they came to Yale. They had gone to school in segregated schools in the South. I didn't know any black people. I hardly knew any Jews before I went to Yale. We all grew up in silos. Even though this was a very diverse country, we all kept to ourselves. Now, everybody I know who are kids has friends of every ethnicity, every race, every immigration status, every sexual orientation, and they all date each other. And so it's a very different country than it was. And Obama represented these kids. Jack Kennedy was my father's age, but he was my first president, my generation's first president. Well, Barack Obama is 52 years or 3 years old now, but he is the first president of this first global generation. And the most extraordinary thing is, for the first time in my political life, the only time more people under 35 voted than were over 65. I was always brought up, seniors are the gold mine. They always vote in higher percentage than everybody else. You got to get the seniors. Young people voted in a much higher proportion than anybody else. Yeah. It was an extraordinary thing. So, this business of inspiring young people to get into politics, it is true that it started in our campaign, but it was perfected by this president who was speaking to a whole new generation, just as Jack Kennedy did 50 years before.
Yeah. On the next Chair Chats, if you were president now, what would be different?
That's a pretty hard question.
To find out more, watch Chair Chats on Monday at 10 a.m.